Good evening and welcome aboard Flight CKCO TV Channel 13 to Japan with stopovers in California, Florida, Indianapolis, Lake Placid, Washington and Hawaii. Today's entertainment is, what happens on the road, stays on the road, so sit back and enjoy. The drink cart will be around shortly.
My name is Paul Brent. I worked at CKCO for 13 years, left in 1989 to work at CTV in Ottawa. While I was with CKCO, I was assistant news director, I was the anchor of the noon show, I was a producer of shows, I was the assistant news director, I did radio, I did TV. In fact, one of my nicknames at the station was Fill In. Every kind of job that needed to be done, hey, Paul could do that. And actually, I love that part of the job, the variety of things that I had the opportunity to do. I thought the station was very progressive in allowing its reporters a lot of leeway to come up with ideas, to work on organizing trips to various parts of the world. I have to take my hat off to the station. And at that time, that was through the 80s when I did most of my traveling, we had one of, if not the biggest newsrooms in Canada. Between reporters in Kitchener-Waterloo, the bureaus that we operated, the stringers that we had, it was a huge operation. We did a lot of innovative stuff in the newscast and allowing people to go out on trips and tell really unique stories, I think, was a big part of what we did. I remember when I went to Hawaii, I was doing a story on a Ward Air pilot who lived in Kitchener-Waterloo but flew out of Toronto, and we flew with him from Toronto to Winnipeg to Honolulu, and then we flew back directly to Toronto. We were on the ground in Hawaii for just under 24 hours. It was a quick visit and a fascinating story, and two really odd things that happened. One, I was on the beach at Waikiki, walking down the beach with John Johnston, my cameraman. We were getting some footage of the beach to do a story on Hawaii as a tourism destination. And I'm walking along the beach and a woman looks up at me and she says, "Hey, Paul Brent from CKCO, good to see ya." And I thought, okay, that's pretty strange. On the plane, on the flight home, I'm walking down the aisle of the plane, getting some exercise during the flight. Guy looks up from his seat, says, "Hey, you're Paul Brent from CKCO, aren't you?" And I just, it was amazing. And it just kind of played into that whole, we're out there covering the world in many ways, and people were out there and they saw us, they recognized us. It was pretty amazing. So in terms of trips, I was so fortunate on so many opportunities that came my way. I think it was a case of the station allowed you to travel if you could pitch a good idea with minimal cost to the station. They picked up some of the costs, but anything you could do to keep costs under control was important. Best trip ever was to Japan. The Toyota Motor Corporation was going to build a new plant in Cambridge, and we thought that it would be a good story if we went to Toyota City in Japan, and here's where Toyota's based, this is what they're all about. And so how this one, we had the idea, but how it came about was, I answered the phone in the newsroom one day. It was somebody from the Toyota Motor Corporation who said, "Do you think anybody at your station would be interested in a trip to Japan and Toyota City?" Unbelievable. I said, "Yes. Yes, indeed." The arrangements started, and away we went. We were on the ground there for 7 days. We shot five feature pieces on life in Japan. We shot stuff in Toyota City. And the city, in fact, had changed its name formally to Toyota City when the company began getting bigger and bigger, and they said, "We need to recognize the importance of this company." funny story about that. As you drive in to Toyota City on their main highway, there is a pedestrian overpass, and on the pedestrian overpass is the silhouette of a car and the name in Japanese, Toyota City. So the people from Toyota were driving us to our first stop of the day. I saw that sign and I said to the cameraman, we should get a shot of that. I said to the fellow who was shepherding us around, can you just take an exit? We got lots of time, spin around, come back, we'll get the shot. Nope, can't do that. Why not? Not on the agenda. He had his clipboard on the agenda that they had lined up. And I said, so how do I get on the agenda? Because we'll be back here tomorrow. He said, oh, I'll make sure it's on the agenda. Next morning when he comes to pick us up at our hotel, he's got his clipboard and he points to, it's all in Japanese, but he points to the section. He says, there you are. You're on the agenda. We're going to get that shot. One of the stories in Japan that was just, it was great fun, and that was a profile of Japanese baseball. And I got two stories out of the one idea. One story became a feature piece for the 6 o'clock news. The other story became a feature length piece for Blue Jays Banter, which we were producing at the station at the time. So the idea was I was going to profile the biggest team in this league that's based in Tokyo. The night we arrive in Tokyo and the Japanese Tourism Association had provided us with a translator and a guide. Anything we needed, he'd help us with. So we're sitting there the night that we arrived, before we went to bed, we're chatting with him, everything's in place, we're all set to go. Well, he says, actually, there's a problem. The baseball team that you were going to profile says they don't want to do the story. I said, you're kidding. I set this up weeks in advance, and sort of the day of, they decide to cancel. He says, well, you know, it's just that's the way it is. They don't want to cooperate with you. And I said, okay, isn't there another team in Tokyo in the same league as the team that I want to profile? He says, yeah, there is. I said, well, you call the team back and say, look, this reporter is going to profile the other team. If you don't want to play ball, pardon the pun, then he's going to go to the other team. He said, I don't think I could do that. I said, no, you do that. We'll see what happens. Next morning, he comes to get us. He says, worked. We're going to the Ball Diamond. So off we go to the Ball Diamond. And when we're at the Ball Diamond, one of the basics of shooting a baseball story is the team is practicing. And you shoot video of their practice. You do all your interviews and you go back the day of the game and you shoot some game footage. So they're exercising and some of the guys are in batting cages and my cameraman, Denny Faucon, terrific sports shooter. He just had such a good sense of how to capture the action of sports. So he goes up to the batting cage and he's shooting video of the players batting. And I'm talking to a representative of the team and my translator is there. And the translator waves me aside and says, look, do you think you could get your cameraman to step back from the batting cage? And I said, no, it's okay. He's been, you know, at major league games all over. He won't get in the way. He knows what he's all about. It'll be fine. Well, you know, the problem is Japanese media pay for access to sports teams. They pay an annual fee. And one of the restrictions that's placed on them is they can't be on the field with their camera. They have to be in the dugouts or along the foul lines. And I look over at the dugout and there's like, I don't know, 10 Japanese cameras from media and they're all shooting batting practice, but they're in the dugout. My guy is right at the cage. He says, please, could you move him back? I said, okay, I can see this is going to create a problem. And the final story about the baseball game was our translator. I had said to him, we want to come back for the baseball game. Oh, no, we can't come back for the game. Why not? Oh, there's no tickets. We have to have a ticket. I said, come on. The team always has tickets. They keep tickets in reserve. This is not a problem. He says, no, can't get it. I said, well, you just go and ask them for it. He comes back. He says, got three tickets, we're good to go. And the Japanese translator had, he was a huge baseball fan. He had never been to the start of a baseball game because he always worked so late, he would get there at maybe the fourth or fifth inning. So we got him there at the start of the game, and he was just so happy. We had decent seats. We put him in the seat. We leave our spare gear with him and say, we're just going to wander around the stadium and get some shots. He says, oh, I better go with you. I said, no, it's okay. We'll get along okay. And he says, no, I better go with you. I said, what's the problem? Why are you so adamant that you want to go with us? He says, well, the last time I brought a media crew here to a game, they were an American TV crew, and they wanted to do the same thing you did. I said, well, see, we're not asking for anything extraordinary. He says, I let them go on their own. They got in a fight in the stands because they were standing in the way of the baseball fans who paid to be there. Baseball fans asked them to move. They said no, and a fight broke out. It was fabulous. Every trip we went on had so many stories. We went to Los Angeles, Long Beach, California. We had the opportunity to be at the factory where they made the space shuttles. And when the day that we were there, the space shuttle Atlantis was being built. And we had the opportunity to walk right into the shuttle, and we were on the flight deck where the control area where the pilots would be. And the stage of construction was the frame had been built, and now they were doing all the wiring on the inside before they closed in the walls. The thing is wires all across the floor, up the walls, and on the ceiling. It was just a wall of wires. It was an unbelievable sight. It was amazing to be in the space shuttle at that point in its construction. I always thought the space shuttle was the epitome of technology and applying that technology in an effective way. We also had the opportunity to go to Florida for the launch of a space shuttle, and we almost missed it. We slept in, the cameraman and I. We were at the hotel, and we'd left a wake-up call with the hotel. We set our alarms. We had to get up at, I think it was 4 a.m., and I remember the phone ringing with the wake-up call, answered it, yep, wake, thanks, bye, click, went right back to sleep. We woke up at the last minute, sprinted to get to the launch point with the media, and John Johnston, my cameraman, was shooting it a video of it, and I was just watching it, and afterwards John said, if I ever have the chance to come to another space shuttle launch, I am not going to look at it through a camera. I am just going to stand there and watch it because it is such a fantastic show. That opportunity isn't going to happen again, obviously, but it was phenomenal to be there. And I remember, if you've ever watched any coverage, you see this huge clock out on a field, the countdown clock, and in the background is the rocket that's being launched or the space shuttle. And that's where they also hold a news conference the day before with media. And somebody asked the question, what would happen if the shuttle blew up? And the guy said, well, you're all going to be standing here where this clock is, and you'll all be vaporized. Oh, great. Great. There's something to keep in mind. Oh, boy. So there was always a little bit of risk of some kind, but after the launch, the following day, we got a chance to go to the vehicle assembly building at Cape Canaveral, which is where they put all the rockets together, it's where they put the space shuttle together, it's where they work on the space shuttle when it comes back from a mission. And we had the opportunity, they were working on a shuttle right then for a next launch. And what they do is they suspend the space shuttle from the ceiling. And the shuttle is about 6.5 feet off the ground. So you can walk underneath the shuttle, and that's where they work on the tiles and the bottom and so on. And that was an amazing feeling to walk underneath that machine from one end to the other. And it's just, you know, it's a foot above your head. It was an unbelievable feeling. Another trip, the Indy 500. Dan Bailey, Dan Bailey was the cameraman. He was a big racing fan, and I was too. And we got the media accreditation to go to the Indy 500. And when I got the media accreditation, I said to them, does this media accreditation get me into the pit area? Because that's the most interesting area to be in. And they said, oh yeah, yeah. So we get there, we go and pick up our media accreditation. We look at the media accreditation, and it does not give us access to the pits. I go back into the office and say, mix up here. You said what I applied for would get me into the pits, and this does not. Too bad, so sad. Don't have time to give you a new one. You're going to have to deal with that. So we then contemplated, well, what are we going to do if we can't get into the pits? That's where you talk to people and you get the real color of the race. And we were staying at a hotel. We had a marked car, CKCO, news vehicle. And the second day that we were there, we come out of our room and parked next to us is a car from CBS Sports. CBS was covering the race. So we say, oh, look at that. They're staying at the same hotel, marked car. Boy, pretty cool. And darned if two guys didn't come out of their room and they were the CBS Sports guys. So we're standing there chatting beside the cars. And I told them my tale of woe about getting the wrong media ID. And they say, oh, we got a couple of extra CBS passes. They'll get you anywhere. Unbelievable luck. Unbelievable. And they did get us anywhere. And one of the most interesting places it got us was the stands that face the straightaway. There's a catwalk up top. So you're probably 120 feet up and you're looking right down the straightaway. Was a great place for a shot. Took us a while to get there, but great place for a shot. We finished covering the race, and of course there was a huge mass of people to leave, and we were actually parked on the infield of the track, and we thought, why sit in traffic? Why don't we just lie down in the grass beside the car and sleep? Because again, we had to get up at, I think it was 4 a.m., and we were both tired after walking around all day. So we lay down, we slept for hour and a half, got up, drove right out. No lineup, traffic was all gone. And then it was a very long, we drove right back to Kitchener, and that was a very, very long drive. The two of us were rotating driving duties. We could only stay awake for about 15 minutes at a time and then had to swap, and you'd go to sleep for 15 minutes and then get up. But we made it back. We made it back.
We interrupt our program to say dinner will be served shortly. Please have your food tray ready. Your options are chicken, sushi, or vegetarian. We now return to Paul Brent and what happens on the road.
Lake Placid, New York. We went there in 1981, the year after the 1980 Olympics, the year that the Americans won the gold medal in hockey, and they were all agog, and Lake Placid was in the headlines. So we wanted to do a story that what happens to a community a year after an Olympics, how does it change a little community like Lake Placid? And the other thing was that the members of the Canadian National Bobsleigh team were going down for a practice, and most of them were from Kitchener-Waterloo area. So we got a ride with them in their van. We went down to Lake Placid. It was the entire time we were there, and we were there for maybe 3 days. I don't think it ever got above minus 30. It was cold, bitterly cold. And for most of the time, we always left our camera outside, because as soon as you brought the camera inside where it was warm, condensation had shut down, end of camera, until it warmed up and dried out. So we just left it outside, and it worked great. And one of the things that we were We were, of course, covering the bobsleigh guys as they were doing their practice routines. And we got talking to one of the members of the American bobsleigh team. He indicated that there was a media guy that had come with them on their last trip. And this media guy wanted to go down in the bobsleigh. It was a four-man team. And he wanted to go down in the bobsleigh. Well, at the bob run in Lake Placid, they have a point halfway down the track where tourists can take a ride. They don't let you go from the top. It's just too dangerous. This reporter was bound and determined to go down from the top. And the team members, the American team members, were saying, no, you don't want to do that. Don't want to do that. He said, I can do it. I can handle it. So they said, fine, you can handle it. Put you in a suit, put a helmet on you, you sit in the middle of the four-man, just put your head down and hope for the best. We'll look after everything else. Turned out when he got to the bottom of the bobsleigh run, he had a bright yellow snowsuit on and he was covered in blood from his head to his toes. What had happened was in almost the first or second turn, the helmet came down and broke his nose. So the nose started to bleed and it just poured out of him because of the G's on the track, just pummeling his body. And the bobsleigh guy said, we all had a good chuckle about that. He wasn't too happy about it, but we thought it was great fun. And I always think back that I should have gone down the bobsleigh run, at least from the halfway point. But my wife had said to me, now, don't you go down a bobsleigh. So I didn't. It was talking about putting the camera outside in the cold. Technology can let you down at the worst possible time. One of the trips that I took was to Washington, D.C. We were doing a story on the U.S. Witness Protection Program. How does it work? We talked to the U.S. Marshals that run the program and interviewed a fellow from the Justice Department. They, too, have a role in how they run the program. We get down to Washington. We go to the Justice Department building first. We go down into the bowels of the company building and like really high security. We finally get to the guy's office that we were to interview. And we're setting up and two things happened. One, we're ready to roll. Cameraman Mike Odrowski says, okay, we're good to go. I ask my first question before the guy even answers the first question. Mike says, hold it, hold it. The tape is jammed in the recorder. At that time, we were using videotape. It had jammed in the recorder. I'm going to have to take the machine apart to get the tape out, find out what the problem is, and put it all back together. So he had his tape recorder, videotape recorder, spread out in parts on the floor of this guy's office. I didn't pay a lot of attention to what he was doing because I couldn't help him. And my bigger concern was that the interview subject got cold feet. He says, I didn't think this was going to be a TV interview. I don't think I want to do this. I said, come on, I'm all the way down from Canada. I told you I was from a TV station. I told you we were going to do an interview with you on camera. I explained all, and you agreed to it. If you pull the pin now, I've made this trip for nothing. It's great talking to you, great information, but this is TV. I have to get you on camera. So while the gear's being fixed, I'm convincing this guy that he really should do the interview. By the time the gear was fixed, he'd agreed to the interview. We got the interview. Then we went to the marshal's office and we got the story. Why, you're wondering, did a local station go to Washington to do the U.S. Witness Protection Program? We were covering, or we were about to cover, a trial of a Hells Angels biker from Cambridge who was a key witness for the prosecution in a murder case. The murder case alleged that another biker killed another biker and that this fellow who was going to testify had been told by the killer what he had done. So he was the key witness. What made this case outstanding, not only that it was local, but this was one of the first murder cases in Canada where a body was never found. And customarily, you can't get a conviction if there's no body because you can't prove the person was murdered. And so the witness was the one who was going to provide the confirmation that a murder took place. The day before he was to testify, the Crown attorney said to the witness, you know that witness protection that we had offered to you? Because as a biker, you testify against another biker, you may not live very long. We're withdrawing that witness protection. We don't think you're at risk of dying. So the jury was ushered out of the room, and there was quite a protracted discussion about whether his life was really at risk or not. And the judge ruled, I don't think you got anything to worry about. So it was a very strange case. It was a local story, and we thought it would be a good story to explain to people how witness protection works in the U.S. versus how it works in Canada. And the people in the U.S. said, if we offer witness protection, we would never withdraw it before a trial. That's just not fair. So that was an interesting legal story. Honolulu, Hawaii. I'd mentioned that before when we were profiling the airline pilot. And it was one of the most challenging times we had with a customs agent. We had all of our gear, and when you go across a border with all of this gear, there's probably $120,000 worth of video and audio gear that we have. And so customs people get very antsy about that. You know, are you importing it? Are you exporting it? Do you owe taxes on it? What's the deal with the gear? We had decided to get what's called a carnet. And a carnet is an internationally recognized customs document that says, this is exactly what they have. They are not importing it. They're not exporting it. They're using it to do their job. We get to customs in Honolulu, and we get a young customs agent, and we hand him the carnet, and clearly he's never seen one in his life. He has no idea what it is. He looks at the bottom line, $120,000 worth of gear, and he says, you guys aren't getting that in here. I said, come on. Do you know what a carnet is all about? He says, I don't care about this piece of paper. You're not bringing that equipment in here. So I said, can I get you to call your supervisor? Oh, and that really upset the agent, really upset him. But he did. He called his supervisor. Supervisor, veteran agent, walks up, says, what's the problem? This guy says, they're bringing in $120,000 worth of gear, and they've got this piece of paper that they say makes it okay. He hands the carnet to the senior officer. He looks at it. Yeah, that's good. Come on in, guys, no problem. And I said, by the way, are you going to be here tomorrow when we fly out at roughly the same time? He says, oh, yeah, I'll be here. And I said, good, because we may run into the same problem on the way out. And we did. Ran into another agent who wasn't sure about a carnet, and that senior officer was not there. But we managed to talk our way through that. You get really good at talking your way in and out of things in order to make it happen. You can't travel a significant distance and not come back with the goods. And speaking of not getting the goods, when we went to Japan, our camera was pretty unique at that time. It was called M format, which is how the tape was threaded through the machine. It was made by Panasonic. It wasn't Sony. It was Panasonic's answer to Sony's market-leading camera. So we get into Tokyo. We're shooting in Tokyo. We've done the baseball story, and we're shooting the next day. We're in a cab. We're shooting from the cab, and the cameraman says, "Oh, tape's jammed, and I can't get it out. This looks really serious. I don't want to damage the camera. We're going to have to get it fixed." And I said, "Well, we're in Japan. The Panasonic is from Japan. This shouldn't be a problem." So we get our translator on it, and we find out that Panasonic is based outside of Tokyo, about an hour away by a bullet train. So if we have to go there, it's going to punch a pretty big hole in our plans for shooting. So our translator calls Panasonic and says, surely you must have a repair facility, a sales, something in Tokyo. And Panasonic says, yes, we do. We have one repair guy to service all of Tokyo. One guy. So we got his address from Panasonic, and we head out to find this guy and to see if he can fix our camera. So this was a perfect example of why you need a fixer when you're on the road. Somebody who translates, somebody who knows the area, somebody that can help you do the things that you need to do. Our guy comes with us in a cab. We have this address in Tokyo. Cab drops us off on the street and says, here you go. And we say, so this looks like a residential area. Cabby says, it's here. We get out of the cab. And I say to the translator, so where's the address? He says, I don't know. It's somewhere on this street. What do you mean, somewhere on this street? He says, well, an odd thing about Japan, the way they number their houses is when they're built. So if you have a house at one end of the street that's built first and it gets number one, and the second house is at the other end of the street, well, that's where number two is. And so, you know, think about it. It's just a hodgepodge of numbers, no rhyme, no reason. So we just start walking down the street, and we found the place. But as we're walking down the street, we walk past a vending machine that was full of beer. And it was everything from a keg of beer to a can of beer. And put your money in and out rolls the cold beer. And I said to our fixer, I said, is this normal? Out in a residential area and there's a vending machine for beer? He says, yeah, they're all over the place. I said, are you not worried about kids putting their money in the machine to get beer? And he looks at me and he goes, why would they do that? And I thought, what a perfect example of the Japanese mindset at that point in time. And we were called gaijin, round eyes. And a lot of people in Japan stared at us because they had never seen a gaijin before. Just, it was something completely out of their knowledge. So in their view, no child would contemplate putting money in a vending machine to get beer. So we found the Panasonic guy's house. He welcomed us in. He had his repair shop in his house, and he fixed the machine for us. I suppose he probably worked on it for an hour, not something that we could have done. And the machine worked like a charm for the rest of the time. It was such a stroke of luck that he was there, we could find him, and we could get it fixed.
This is the captain speaking. We have started our descent into Tokyo. We'd like to thank Paul Brent. What happens on the road, stays on the road. We hope to see you again.